I am very pleased and quite honored to introduce our speaker tonight, Dr. J. M. Smith, Professor of History at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Dr. Smith is a renowned specialist of early modern France, especially in the later 17th and 18th centuries. His first two monographs, which I have up here now, titled The Culture of Merit, Nobility, Royal Service, and the Making of Absolute Monarchy in France, and Nobility Reimagined, the Patriotic Nation in 18th Century France. In these texts, Dr. Smith has endeavored to comprehend the underpinnings of power and hierarchy. He has written about the development of royal absolutism, the emergence of patriotic habits of thought, the origins of the French Revolution, and the history of the nobility. He is now at work on a book that will examine attitudes toward truth-telling in the political world of the 18th century North Atlantic. You don't even need to set that up. So his current research on truth-telling is perhaps telling itself, a reflection of both who Dr. Smith is and what he values. Dr. Smith is a vocal promoter of academic freedom and an even fiercer advocate for vulnerable populations, particularly the exploited student-athlete caught in the net of big-time college sports. In a book he recently co-authored with Mary Willingham, titled Cheated, the UNC Scandal, the Education of Athletes, and the Future of Big-Time College Sports, Dr. Smith helped expose the decades-long efforts of administrators, coaches, boosters, alumni, and even one professor to profit from and not apologize for the exploitation of young athletes' bodies while denying them the right to cultivate their minds. Cheated showed that big-time sports universities nurture a sports-first culture. The student-athletes there, and not just at UNC, are often given only the faintest hint of the education that is supposed to act as payment for their participation on the field. Dr. Smith's integrity and determination to hold university officials, administrators, and coaches accountable in the face of stark resistance deserves all of our respect and our admiration. But tonight, we are here to hear about a different scandal, a different controversy, one that involved the deaths of over 100 individuals and purported monster responsible. Dr. Smith's presentation treats the fascinating legend surrounding the beast of the Gévaudan, real creatures with exaggerated qualities that stalked the imaginations of 18th century French men and women. His talk is taken from his highly acclaimed 2011 book, Monsters of the Gévaudan, The Making of a Beast. So everybody, please join me in welcoming Dr. Smith.
Thank you, Joseph, for that overly generous introduction. Appreciate that. And I'm happy to be staring down a different sort of monster tonight than the one that I had to grapple with at UNC while I was battling with the over the athletic scandal. Anyway, it's always a pleasure for me to talk about one of my favorite stories. And I want to thank Darlene Hurd and Joseph Bryan and Jen Len for inviting me for this occasion so that I could have one more chance to talk about the Beast of the Gévaudan. What I'd like to do tonight is use the case of this one famous story from 1760s France to reflect on the very nature of the monstrous. I know that many of you have attended earlier lectures in this series. You've already learned a good bit or heard a good bit about the historically specific conditions in which early modern Europeans thought about monsters and investigated monsters and observed them for scientific purposes. But monsters then and now, maybe more now than then, have meanings that transcend science. The word monster, the word monstrous, have psychological and emotional and moral dimensions of meaning or registers of meaning that in some ways are even more important than the scientific understanding of the monster. And so what I'm going to do tonight in reviewing the story of the Beast of the Gévaudan and how it became such a big story in the middle of the 1760s is try to talk a bit about both the historically specific conditions in France in the 1760s that predisposed people to think about this animal as a monster. And then I'll invite you to ponder with me toward the end of the talk the features of the story that make it appealing to us today, too, in the 20th and 21st centuries, as a story about a monster. That is, it appealed to people in the 1760s as a monster tale, and it still appeals today as a monster tale. And so maybe we can think about why that is. That's essentially the focus of the talk. Okay, so a little bit of background. The Beast of the Gévaudan was a mysterious creature that bounded out of the woods in a very remote and rustic south-central French province called the Gévaudan in the summer of 1764, and that led a rampage that, depending on how you chronicle the tale, lasted for 14 months or perhaps for 3 years. Because the people in the Gévaudan weren't convinced that the Beast of the Gévaudan had been conquered until June of 1767, and they had good reason to think that. But the official story really ends October 1st, 1765, for reasons we'll talk about. But this mysterious creature killed its first victim on June 30th, 1764, and eventually went on to take 102 more lives over the course of the next 3 years. And while this was happening, and incidentally, I should mention that all of the victims, all of them were peasants. They were poor peasants, women and children, entirely. Women and children entirely. While this was happening, the imaginations of the people in the Gévaudan and all over France ran wild. Whoops. So let me just locate the phenomenon for you, locate this event for you. So this is a topographic map of France. The Gévaudan is the old province that is encircled by the dotted line. And the area covered by the smallest square toward the top of the larger square was the area most affected by the beast's ravages. Something like 60, 65 of the victims came from that one very circumscribed area. And I'll just also direct your attention down toward the Mediterranean coast, where you'll also see the city of Montpellier, which figures in the story in a couple of important ways. The administrative overseers of the Gévaudan actually worked in the Montpellier. And so while the beast was, you know, working its evil, and so many hunters were scouring the land looking for it, people in Montpellier were keeping a close watch on what was going on. And locals were communicating continuously with officials in Montpellier about all of it. A couple of things to note about the region. Then, as now, very, very sparsely populated. I would guess, I have no way of proving it, but I would guess that the animals outnumbered the people in the Gévaudan. It's a very rugged region. Actually, you can see that. If I switch back here, with the exception of the Pyrenees and the Alps on the borderland regions to the south and the southeast, you can see that this area in south central France where these killings took place is the most mountainous and rugged area in the entire country. And it was also home to some of the worst soil in the country. And so it was inhospitable, generally speaking. Not many people lived there. Farms didn't function very well. It was populated almost entirely, really, by sheep herders and people who tended small farms with their herds. So wolves roamed freely in this area, and they had a long history of targeting humans. Remember how Charles Dickens starts A Christmas Carol? He says, Jacob Marley was dead as a doornail. There's no doubt about it. And you need to understand that if you're going to take anything of value away from this story. Jacob Marley was dead. Well, I need to tell you, it was wolves. It was wolves that did this. The amount of circumstantial evidence pointing to wolves is overwhelming. And there was also a fair amount of eyewitness evidence that accumulated over time, particularly in 1765. It made it clear to objective observers that these people were dying because there was a wolf infestation in the Gévaudan. And there had been previous wolf infestations all over France, going back to the late Middle Ages. It is estimated that as many as 9,000 people were killed by wolves in France between about 1500 and about 1800. So they inflicted a lot of damage. And yet, they imagined that there was something monstrous out there in the fields that was targeting them. Well, you can sort of understand why just by looking at the landscape. It's a spooky landscape. This is a picture that I took standing on the side of a highway. I didn't do anything to alter the angle. This is just the way the land, this is the lay of the land here in the Gévaudan. And one of the strangest features of the landscape is that it has these granite outcroppings that are kind of hard to explain. And sometimes they look like they have faces. And that inspired in early modern peasant communities lots of legends about how those granite outcroppings really got there and whether they harbored fairies and whether they had magical qualities to them. It's just a kind of creepy place and often very, very dark. And here I just wanted to share with you a picture of one very typical village. This is the village of Nozerolles, which was one of the hardest hit villages in that little square that I showed you earlier. 8 or 10 people from this tiny village were attacked over this 3-year rampage by the Beast of the Gévaudan. And you can sort of imagine just by looking at the landscape, the surroundings of the village, why people might have imagined that there was evil lurking in the woods, that there was something monstrous in there, because this is obviously a very wooded, rugged area. There's no light, there's no civilization anywhere. Of course, their imaginations are going to run wild. But what is it to think about the monstrous? What did it mean for them to imagine that there were monsters or monsters in the woods coming after them? Why did they think this? This is just for the sake of throwing another neat picture really into the PowerPoint. I wanted to suggest some of the enduring features of monstrosity. Some of the characteristics we associate or impute to those we imagine to be monsters. I mean, I think this is a nice representation of at least some of those features. All of those great Universal Pictures studios from the 1930s with Frankenstein and Dracula and the Mummy and the Creature of the Black Lagoon, which came a little bit later in the early 50s. They suggest some of the some of the universal features of the monster. I won't spend too much time on this because it's kind of obvious. Monsters are associated with the dark. Right, both the Mummy and Dracula came out of coffins, and Frankenstein came out of a laboratory run by a mad scientist in his basement, essentially, and the creature from the Black Lagoon came from a black lagoon. The darkness is just, it's one of the things we associate with monsters. It's one of the reasons they find it so easy to hide and spring their attacks, you know, without anyone suspecting it. They tend to be large and menacing and ugly. They're associated with death or with inflicting death. It is assumed that they're up to no good. They're nefarious creatures. They have sinister motives. And they often have uncommon powers that seem outside the rules of nature. Fine, so we'll revisit that. some of the universal qualities of the monster toward the end of the talk. But let me take a little while now to talk about the specifics of the environment of France in the 1760s that predisposed French men and women all over the country to imagine that there was a fiendish monster running around in the woods in the Gévaudan. And as quickly as I can, move through each of these five conditioning factors as I recount the tale. Journalists were eager for sensational news. One in particular, from the city of Avignon, was eager to find news that would compensate for the lack of war news in the mid-1760s. Newspapers always sold best when there was a war going on. But unfortunately, for journalists, the French had just recently concluded a devastating war, the Seven Years' War, and this one journalist, followed by others, found in the Bistro de Gévaudan a sensational story to hype and to take the place of grisly war news that sold so many papers. So there's that. Also, following the Seven Years' War, there was a generalized malaise in France as a whole. The Seven Years' War was a disastrous war for the French. It was humiliating because although they had up to this time thought of themselves with reason as the largest and most powerful army on the continent, they were repeatedly beaten by the tiny Prussian army, well, not so tiny, but smaller. They were repeatedly beaten by the Prussians. They lost to the English in North America. They eventually lost virtually all of their overseas empire as a result of this war. It was a disaster for France. And as a result, I suggest, and I'll show you some specifics of why I suggest this, there was a craving for victory and redemption in the wake of the war. And fighting a ghastly beast running around in the forests in south central France was one way to do that, to gain some redemption. There was also a related desire for victories and for heroism and for expressions of good French qualities in the wake of the humiliating Seven Years' War. There were religious feelings, religious passions, religious ideologies that had taken root. Well, actually, you could trace these ideologies and these passions back to the Reformation. But there were particular conflicts in the middle of the 18th century that predisposed certain religious figures to see in the Bistro de Gévaudan a kind of miraculous event that also could be construed through the lens of the monstrous. And finally, there was an overlapping in the culture between elites who, as Joseph Bryan, I think, explained to you in his lecture last week, if you were there, had their own intellectual reasons for caring about the monstrous and understanding it better, and a broader culture that was just jazzed by the exotic, by things that were scary, that were unusual, unfamiliar. This becomes a very salient characteristic of 18th century culture, in part because of French and European engagement with new worlds across the seas and elsewhere. So all of these things contributed, I think, to make the ground of France in 1765 very fertile soil for monstrous thinking. So I'll just quickly repeat here what I mentioned about this journalist in Avignon, François Morinas, who worked at the Courrier d'Avignon. The 18th century, I should say, was the birthplace of modern journalism. We 18th century specialists like to call the 18th century the birthplace of just about everything, I will admit that. But there's a lot of truth to it, you know. And it is true that it's in the 18th century that you see for the first time, for example, daily newspapers, regular reporting on political and diplomatic affairs, and crucially, I want to emphasize, what you might think of as human interest stories. Stories that were bound to get the attention of readers simply because they were unusual or quirky or shared details that people did not encounter in their daily lives. And this guy, François Morinas, was one of the most inventive and resourceful journalists of the 18th century. And he in particular, I think, can be credited with inventing the modern human interest story. And the Beast of the Gévaudan was one of his first. And he made hay with this story. He sensationalized every bit of news he received from his various correspondents in the province and friends from Paris who were hearing from their correspondents in the province. He seized on every unusual detail, blew it up as big as he could, and used it to sell newspapers. He was a major contributor to the myth that surrounded this beast. Other major contributors included soldiers, particularly aristocratic officers, who had played important roles in the Seven Years' War, and who happened to be either living in or stationed in the Gévaudan when this rampage began. There are two important figures. First, the Comte de Morangis was actually, besides the Bishop of Mende, who was the richest and most powerful aristocrat in the whole region, the Morangis was the next most important aristocrat in the region. He had more wealth than anybody else, more standing. His father, in particular, had a sterling reputation until the Seven Years' War. His father, the Marquis de Morangis, had presided over one of the most humiliating defeats of the war in 1759, a siege at the town of Minden that led to his ignoble capitulation to the English, after which he was so embarrassed he simply resigned his commission and came home. The Comte de Morangis took this as a stinging defeat for his family name and was eager, I believe, in his work in the Gévaudan fighting the beast, eager to regain some of the honor and reputation that his family had lost in the Seven Years' War. And you can see a little bit of that just in this one letter that he wrote to a minor administrative official when he was volunteering to be the chief huntsman who would take it upon himself to eliminate the scourge from the province. This is about 3 months in to the story. That is, the first victim had fallen on June 30th. This is around October, mid to late October. And still the provincial administrators are trying to figure out how they're gonna contend with this crisis. They haven't named an official first huntsman or chief huntsman yet. Morangis is lobbying for the job. And just notice the language that he uses in his letter lobbying for this job. He wants to bring military discipline to this operation. If you engage me on this commission, you'll not believe what a little military discipline will do in this operation. He was disappointed. He did not get that commission, but he did often help the person who did over the next 6 months. That was Captain Jean-Baptiste Duhamel. Duhamel's story is singularly affecting. He benefited from the patronage of one of the most powerful nobles in all the realm, the Comte de Clermont, who was a cousin of Louis XV, and who was a high-placed court noble who had been given a commission as an officer in the Seven Years' War, and who also had lost a string of humiliating defeats to the English and the Prussians, and was forced eventually to go off into retirement, into exile, with his tail between his legs. But Duhamel felt great loyalty to his patron, the Comte de Clermont, and wrote to him repeatedly during the scavenges of the Beast of the Gévaudan to inform him on how the hunt was going and to let him know that he sure hoped that in the end he would help to redeem the dragoon company for which he had been recruited of the Comte de Clermont. So he too, like Morangis, saw this opportunity as a chance at reclaiming honor for one of his benefactors who'd been stained by the war. Duhamel, I should mention, I suppose, was recruited specifically by the Comte de Clermont for a new dragoon regiment. Dragoons are, they ride on horseback, but they're actually infantry soldiers, so they're very mobile. They're useful for all sorts of operations. And it had performed, this regiment had performed poorly in the war, but Duhamel happened to be stationed in the Gévaudan in 1764. And so he was the officer who, in the end, was selected to lead the general hunts, the various hunts against the beast. And there is this very moving moment in the story of the hunt for the beast of the Gévaudan that occurs in late December of 1764, when he and his dragoons, his colleagues, have staged a hunt on the grounds of the Chateau of La Baume, because they've been alerted to suspicious activity on the grounds. They believe maybe the monster is there. Duhamel and his men go there. They beat the woods for several hours. Then late in the afternoon, Duhamel relays in letters to many of his friends and patrons after the fact. Late in the afternoon of 23 December 1764, he is stationed on foot. Here's the beast. Turns, he claims in his letters, he's only 4 paces away from the beast, and he's taking aim, he's ready to fire, when his men come bounding in from another angle, and they startle the beast, and they startle Duhamel, and the beast gets away. Duhamel says, this is the most crushing moment of his life. He says this in his letters, because he had hoped that he would be able to bag the bounty and celebrate the felling of the beast of the Gévaudan on behalf of the Comte de Clermont. He wrote this in his letters, but it didn't happen. Beast got away. But this is not even the end of the tragedy, or of the comedy, depending on how you look at it. His men, feeling very guilty about what they had done, gave chase to the beast immediately. And they pursued him for 15 minutes, for a quarter of an hour, until weirdly, in the middle of a very wooded estate, they came upon a high wall that they claimed. The beast leaped straight over, but that their horses couldn't possibly attempt. The beast jumped right over the wall and eluded them, and their horses refused to give chase because this wall was just too high. And so this is commemorated in another print. It came out just a couple of weeks after the event. Literally, this is the language that's used in this engraving. He leaps the highest walls in a single bound. Superman, you've got nothing on me. This is the beast of the Gévaudan we're talking about. So Duhamel and his men, in the wake of this great escape, decide tacitly, or perhaps quite consciously, we can't say for sure, they decide to make the beast out to be even greater and more menacing and more threatening and more terrible than he was. And I'd like to read to you from a letter he wrote around this time, in which he described the beast. He claims to be relaying the eyewitness report of a woman who had been attacked by the beast and had miraculously survived that attack, who fought the beast off somehow. This animal, he says, is about the size of a year-old bull. Its neck and belly are white. The fur of the body is red, and the length that of a wolf. It has a black stripe running down its back with very long fur. The stripe, that is very long. The tail resembles that of a horse, red and bushy, with touches of black. The paws are very powerful, with six talons. Six. Not four, not five, as you would expect in a... But no, six. Each the length of a finger. He would say in another letter that he wrote about a week after this, I can attest to the length of the talons because the woman told me that each time the beast reared itself back on its hind legs to jump on her, she had the time to count the talons and measure them. The head is black with a wide forehead. The eyes are large and sparkling, and its muzzle is the length of that of a pig, with the difference that the muzzle points down instead of up. Very, very precise. Its mouth is extraordinarily broad, measuring at least a foot, when it's open, that is. The teeth are wide and pointy at the end, with a half-inch gap separating one from the other. So the failure at La Baume really got to Duhamel, and he poured a lot of energy into making the Beast of the Gévaudan a terrible animal. How do we know that he was driven to do this, to represent the beast as something awful? He went to Montpellier. About a week after the failure at La Baume, he went to Montpellier, and he engaged the services of a painter who painted an image of the beast as depicted by Duhamel in his letter. And then he took that portrait to an engraver who ran off multiple copies of the engraving, which Duhamel then sent to all of his superiors and his patrons and friends back in Paris, so that they would be convinced that this was a really, really terrible animal. And I can't be blamed for not catching him. He's got superhuman powers, this person, or this thing. We don't know for sure, we don't know for sure that this is the image that he had painted and then reproduced in Montpellier, but it is labeled as the portrait of the hyena, more about that later, portrait of the hyena, the ferocious beast that desolates the Gévaudan, as seen by Monsieur Duhamel, the dragoon officer of the volunteer regiment of Clermont. And then this or something like it was distributed widely all across the country so that people would see that this is not your usual animal. It's certainly not a wolf. I don't know what that looks like, honestly. I don't know what it is. We know he was very territorial about the image of the beast in the spring of 1765 because he complained when he discovered that other artists and other engravers were circulating other images of the beast that did not resemble the one that he had composed. So he was very heavily invested, this is my point, in making the Beast of the Gévaudan into something awful. Just a couple of weeks after these incidents, the failure at La Baume and Duhamel's trip to Montpellier, there was another remarkable occurrence in the long history of the Beast of the Gévaudan that drew wide attention. And this was an attack by the beast, or an animal reputed to be the beast, on a small troop of children led by one Jacques Portefeuille, a peasant boy who was playing in the fields, playing in the pastures with five male friends and two females. And who was, I'm sorry about the image, the quality of the image, incidentally, but this is a very miniature image that I've blown up here, and so it loses a lot of its definition. But you can see in general what the encounter was like, at least according to all of the journalistic reports and some eyewitness accounts. The beast attacked one of the children who's there lying in front of the beast there, and Jacques Portefeuille, the brave little 12-year-old peasant boy, responds to this attack by rallying his friends and going to attack the beast, which they do with their pikes. And to make a long story short, eventually they chase the beast away. and the person who was attacked, the youngster that was attacked, survived. And this got a lot of attention. As you can imagine, the story of Jacques Portefeuille and his small troop of companions stretched all across Europe. This happened in mid-January. By the end of March, everybody in Europe knew about this. News about Portefeuille even reached Boston and New York and Philadelphia. If you look at the contemporary newspapers in those cities, again, you will see accounts of Portefeuille's battle with the beast. And this was so inspired. This happens to be a German engraving, incidentally, that tells the entire tale in great detail. I'm sorry I can't take the time to spell out each step. It's an amazing story. But it was so inspiring that Louis XV was prompted to award all of the seven children or eight children small monetary gifts. And he decided that Jacques Portefeuille was such an example of French patriotism and courage and bravery that he would make a perfect officer in his armies. And so he had him educated. The kid couldn't read. He sent him to Montpellier, sent him to school for a year or two. He learned how to read and write. And then he was sent to an officer school and wound up an officer in the French army. He died in 1785 as an officer in Louis XV's armies. Is that not remarkable? It was because this story, it clearly met a psychological need, a psychological craving on the part not only of Louis XV, but of the many other people who heard about it and who celebrated it in poems and songs for a French hero who could, with his own resolve, his own resources, his own innate bravery, stand up to the fiercest fiend imaginable. But this is, of course, another story that makes the beast all the greater and all the more menacing than it probably really was in real life. So think about this. So we've got journalists who are capitalizing on the appeal of this sensational story. We've got aristocratic warriors who are looking to redeem themselves in the aftermath of a failed war. We've got little heroes who miraculously are able to step forward and fill a vacuum in the French psyche in the mid-1760s. All of these factors are helping to make this wolf series of wolf attacks into something extraordinary and truly monstrous. And then there was also the Bishop of Mende himself. The Bishop of Mende, who, as I mentioned earlier, was the most important, most powerful aristocrat in the province of the Gévaudan, and was an important Catholic prelate who had great influence in the church, and who was struck by all of these stories, the escape story at La Baume in particular, and earlier stories from the fall of 1764 that seemed to defy credulity. He was struck by them, and he decided to announce on January 1st his interpretation, or his understanding of what was happening to the people of the Gévaudan. And I'm going to read to you from a circular that he published and had sent all around the province in early January. A ferocious beast has appeared, as if by a miracle, no one knowing whence it comes. Wherever it appears, it leaves bloody traces of its cruelty. It combines strength with trickery and surprise. It brings down its prey with incredible speed and agility. The bishop implied that the beast could only be vanquished by what he called holy violence, violence that would be authorized by God's will. And this was because, he explained, the beast was in fact a weapon drawn from the arsenal of God's anger to execute the death sentences that his justice has pronounced. The beast, in short, was the tool of an angry God, punishing irreligious citizens of the region in the most searing way possible by taking away their innocent children. the beast stalked the region, he was implying, using a form of divine magic to carry out its assaults. And only heartfelt prayer and contrition could persuade God to take mercy. And that's precisely what he urged in this circular, that everyone come to a feeling of heartfelt contrition, pray continuously, atone for your sins, promise to raise your children in godly ways, stop ignoring your religious duties. And if you do, God will grant someone the divine sword it will take to strike down your enemy. So in saying this, the Bishop of Mende was suggesting that the beast was doing God's work. It was an agent of divine justice, which would have encouraged a lot of people to imagine that this wasn't your run-of-the-mill ordinary wolf, of course, that was doing the damage. Maybe it was a werewolf. Because theologians had been explaining since the 16th century, or had been trying to persuade the superstitious among their flocks, that werewolves weren't really diabolical agents. They weren't doing the devil's work. They didn't really rub themselves down with devil's grease in order to change their form. No, they were actually doing God's work. This is a trope of 16th century theology. And I think it's fair for us to assume that the parishioners of the Bishop of Mende, when they heard that the beast is in fact to be understood as an agent of divine justice, they might have thought that it was a werewolf that was doing all of this bad stuff out in the fields. Finally, I'm not going to spend too much time on this one because I know you've heard a bit about it already. But as I said, there was this overlap in the popular culture and in learned culture in the middle of the 18th century over the category of the monster. Everybody was interested in monsters, whether you were learned, semi-learned, or ignorant. You were interested in monsters. And because of the many descriptions that were pouring in from the Gévaudan and other places about the physical characteristics and strange abilities of the beast, it was almost inevitable, I would say, that people were going to associate this creature with the monstrous. So here I'm just going to run quickly through a bunch of images that were generated at the time and that purported to capture eyewitness accounts of the beast as seen out in the fields attacking people. Clearly, it's kind of made to look like a lion here. Many emphasized, as we can understand, that it sure was suspicious that it was only women and children who were being attacked by the beast, because this suggests some sort of sinister, diabolical plot, really, on the part of the malefactor. In fact, women and children were the people in peasant communities who took sheep and herds to pasture and streams. They were the ones who were standing vulnerable in the areas where wolves might be prowling. And that almost certainly explains why it's only women and children who were killed. But still, you can understand why there would be curiosity about this. The variety of descriptions of its torso, its length, the nature of its hide, its teeth, its ears, I can't even begin to go into it, but you get at least a sense of some of the representations here. It was reputed to, like a cat, ready to jump on a mouse. It liked to be playful a little bit, and it twitched its tail. It often twitched its tail before it pounced. Now, how anyone could view the beast for such a duration of time to note all the twitching it does with its tail and not take any action against the beast, not fire at it, for example, is another mystery. But, yeah. Here's the only representation that I know of, contemporary representation, that actually depicts the beast with six talons as described by Duhamel. Duhamel said it had six talons, right? It's the only one available that I have seen that actually has six. Again, this is kind of absurd. It didn't have six talents. It's sneaky. It always attacks from behind. It makes miraculous escapes. There's a famous story from May of 1765 involving these three noble brothers, noble huntsmen from the Gévaudan, the La Chaumette brothers, who claimed that one fine morning they woke up and saw the beast on their estate. And they all three of them went and grabbed their muskets and they fired. And they saw the beast fall. And they thought, this is great. We've got the beast at the Gévaudan. And they gathered up their stuff. They gathered up their guns, I guess. And they ran toward this copse of trees where the beast had fallen. And by the time they got there, the beast was gone. It had disappeared into the woods, only to attack two more people later that same day. So this becomes part of the mythology of the beast. It has this ability to escape the most skilled huntsmen, even when they have managed to shoot it. It was also reputed to be able to deflect lead shells. Another kind of crazy notion. Here's, it's depicted with shiny, glowing eyes, looking very demonic. So you can see that there are all sorts of reasons for the average reader in Paris or Montpellier or Avignon or parishioner in Gévaudan to think that there was something really, really unusual out there in the woods. What I want to close with is one other notion, one other factor that was specific to the time, but I want to suggest also transcends the time, and that was the new attraction of the aesthetic category of the sublime in the middle of the century. This aesthetic category was reinvented by Edmund Burke and Denis Diderot and other writers in the 1760s and 70s, in part because they were trying to look beyond the classical conceptions of beauty in art and elsewhere. I'm going to share a little snippet from Edmund Burke. I'll direct your attention particularly toward the last bullet point. According to Edmund Burke, the sight of the sublime caused astonishment, a state of the soul in which all its motions are suspended with some degree of horror. So the sublime is associated with the terrible and the horrific, which is one of the reasons we're attracted to it, Burke was suggesting. Here's Diderot echoing Burke. Diderot was very influenced by Burke. That text that I just quoted was a very influential treatise on aesthetics in the late 18th century. Diderot agreed that darkness and obscurity are important conditions for glimpsing the sublime, because only darkness and obscurity produce the sensation of awe, of almost a paralysis in the face of the sight of the sublime. So how do we define the sublime, or how did they define the sublime? See, these are some of its characteristics. The sublime is not an entirely new category, I must confess. The ancients talked about the sublime. There had been some 17th century treatises about the sublime. But it was Burke and Diderot and theorists of the late 18th century and artists and poets of the late 18th century that particularly emphasized its associations with darkness and obscurity and terror. The fact that the sublime can induce feelings of terror in you is one of the things that makes it so thrilling. Now, very frequently in the art and literature of the late 18th and early 19th centuries, as the Romantics took up this category and ran with it, very often the sublime is represented in the way we see here, individuals grappling with the forces of nature alone and in the dark, but still affording the viewer an appreciation for nature's majesty. But sheer terror, sheer fear, was also part of what made up the sublime and made it attractive, according to Burke and others, in the second half of the 18th century. The sublime is great because it scares the bejesus out of us, essentially. And I want to suggest that this is one of the reasons so many people, even elites, educated people who should have known better, were willing at least to suspend disbelief for a while and imagine that this creature that was doing all of these terrible things to these poor people, because after all, we take a little bit of delight in this, don't we? When we hear that the people are being scared to death and attacked. And now Burke did say, that one of the reasons the sublime is so powerful is that after it makes us feel delight in hearing about the suffering of others, it brings us back to feelings of empathy. We're brought back, as we step back from the precipice and we realize we ourselves are not threatened, we do feel empathy and sympathy for these people who are suffering. And that is a very human and obviously commendable emotion. So the sublime is also associated with that. But first, it has to scare you to death. And that's what Burke was celebrating. So these are a couple of rhetorical questions I want to pose. Did the Age of Enlightenment actually conjure scary monsters because it was an Age of Enlightenment? Did the rational conquest of nature create a psychological thirst for the inexplicable? I want to answer yes. I mean, I am inclined to answer yes. I think so. And I'll just close by contrasting, just juxtaposing a few images that represent the beast. First, I'll have to tell you a little bit about the setup for this. In late September 1765, the third of the three chief huntsmen that Louis XV sent down to the Gévaudan to find the beast finally killed a large wolf on the grounds of the Abbey Church of Les Chats in southern Auvergne, which borders on the Gévaudan. And for a variety of reasons, we could talk about it if you would like in the Q&A. For a variety of reasons, this person, François Antoine, who did the shooting, and the folks back at court, and local administrators all decided, hey, let's just declare this thing over. Can we declare victory and go home now? And they actually embalmed this wolf and sent it to Versailles, and it was displayed for the king and the court. I'll show you another picture in just a second, representing this moment on October 1st, 1765. But there were lots of representations of this hunt in November of 1765, celebrating the victory over the beast. And I just want to point out to you how classically aesthetic this particular picture is, right? We've got perfect symmetry. You've got François Antoine and one of his deputies on either side of the beast, this force of disruption and disorder that's caused so much havoc and that is finally being exterminated by the forces of the royal government. And extending behind them is an alleyway that actually leads back to the Abbey Church at Les Chats. And that alleyway is policed now by the dogs, the royal dogs who had helped in the hunt. And so I want to suggest, I'm not an art historian, I have to confess, but this is my reading of this image, that this is a proud representation on the part of the state and those who are celebrating the state's victory of the restoration of order, the elimination of a troubling disruption that has afflicted our consciences now for a year. And here we see order restored, as we do here Whoops. So this is this large wolf that's sent back to Versailles and is embalmed and propped up with, it's an interesting story, how they got the beast ready for its presentation to the king. It was already half rotten. We were pretty sure of this. But here is a famous representation of the king and his court laying their hands on the beast, taking control of this disruptive force. And, you know, after this famous display, we don't even know what happens to the carcass. They just threw it away somewhere. We don't know. They disposed of it, of this threat to order. So that is one of the dominant narratives that takes shape in the aftermath of this killing in late September of 1765. Order has been restored. We can all praise and thank our king and his agents for having done this for us. Hallelujah. But at the same time, another narrative took shape. Another fantastic narrative, which insisted that, in fact, the beast of the Gévaudan was not just your average wolf. It was something extraordinary. Perhaps it was a hyena, even though the guy who had shot the animal said, it's a wolf. No, there was this counter narrative in the public sphere that, no, it was a hyena. It had to be a hyena, because we've been wanting to believe this for so long. We just have to. You can't take this from us. We want to believe it was a hyena. And fast forward to today, and I'm just going to quickly show you a few images of the beast as depicted in modern art and statuary. This is a statue in the town of Auvers that celebrates another notable encounter in the history of the beast of the Gévaudan, when a 19-year-old girl with her staff managed to repel the beast and actually draw blood from the beast, according to eyewitnesses. But you see how the beast is depicted here. That's no wolf. That is something weird. It's something monstrous. And quickly, I'll just very quickly run through other modern representations of the beast of the Gévaudan. In the 21st century, we refuse to believe that this is anything other than a monster. And so what I want to suggest in closing is that, yeah, there were lots of historically specific conditions that turned this creature into a monster in the 1760s. But a taste for the sublime, I want to suggest, is something that we have in common with the 18th century and may very well be a characteristic of modernity, that we moderns, who have conquered nature in so many ways and who have asserted our mastery over the natural world in so many ways, I think, like Edmund Burke, like Denis Diderot, want to imagine that there are inexplicable, fearsome things out there, and we want to see them if possible, if only for a moment. Even if they will cause paralysis in us, we want to see it. So have a sublime Halloween, everyone. Yeah.
And it's purely just for information. And no offense to any journalists sitting here. You talk about the journalistic quid to make this maybe a bigger story than it was. I've known a few journalists that like to argue. So were there no counter stories that said you guys are full of whatever they were called back then? We have a whole fantastic.
Great question. So the question is, if there were journalists out there hyping this story to be bigger than it really was, were there counter narratives by other journalists or others who were contending that this was perfectly normal? Yes, there were. They were fewer in number, and they did not gather, I would say that they did not reach critical mass until the summer of 1765. After a series of disappointing near misses and increasingly strange stories that defied credulity began to accumulate, people, generally speaking, and some journalists began doubting the fantastic stories. And by the end of the, from June of 1765, really to the end of 1767, it's only the Courrier d'Avignon that continues to report the stories of the Beast of the Gévaudan. Before that, in late 64, early 65, every paper in Europe was picking up on the Courrier's stories, essentially syndicating them, which they were being syndicated in essence. They didn't have that concept. They didn't have the concept of plagiarism or copyright. So, you know, the Gazette d'Amsterdam and the London Chronicle and the Gazette de Lyde and the Gazette de France, they're all running the same stories. But by the summer of 65, the others begin to pull back. They're suspicious. So, yes, in the end, more sensible heads prevailed in journalistic circles, I suppose you could say. Yeah, yes. Right. Okay. Right. Well, I mentioned that the king and François Antoine, his royal gun bearer who killed that big wolf, and many other people wanted this to be the end of the story. And so they celebrated the big kill. But then about 6 weeks later, people in the Gévaudan begin dying again because there are more animals wreaking more havoc. And from November 65 to June 67, another 35 or 40 people die. Interestingly, though, as far as the state is concerned, back in Paris, Versailles, the story is over. The story is over. We killed our beast. We vanquished the monster, and that's the end of it. And they essentially left the provincials to their own devices. They sent them some manuals on how to poison predators, particularly wolves, very detailed manuals on how to do this. And they offered a little bit in the way of resources to help with this, but they refused to send anybody else down to the Gévaudan. And you can understand why. I mean, very prominent aristocratic huntsmen had been humiliated for 14 months running. And the crown did not want to risk a repeat. And so they decided the story was over. But provincials in the Gévaudan, they knew better. And this is one of the reasons why, to this day, a counter-narrative about the beast, really the most popular narrative about the beast, has persisted. It's because the people in the Gévaudan said, hey, wait a minute, that François Antoine guy, he didn't really kill the beast. We killed it. We did it through our ingenuity and our know-how and our ability to navigate our difficult landscape. We did it. And we know that it was a monster. It was a monster. It wasn't just some big wolf that Antoine, as Antoine claimed. So there's an official story about when it ended. October 1st, 1765. And there's the real story, and that's June 1767.
So how did they get it?
There was another wolf killing, another signal wolf killing in late June of 1767 by a local peasant. Actually, there was a general hunt organized by the Marquis d'Apcher, who was a prominent nobleman in the region, and one of the peasants who lived on his estates, who happened to be a skilled marksman, for whatever reason. It's unusual for a peasant to be a skilled marksman, but he was. And he killed another large wolf in late June of 1767. And it's interesting what happens, because they mimicked the process that Antoine and the king had gone through in October of 65 to celebrate and commemorate what had happened here. They too brought in a bunch of doctors and veterinarians and naturalists to examine the carcass. They did a very detailed autopsy. They described it in ways that made it sound more fantastic than it probably was. And thereby, they claimed that they were the ones who had vanquished the beast of the Gévaudan. So. Yes? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so the first question was, were all of these people actually killed? Can we verify that they were killed? If so, were they killed in more or less the same way? And the answer to that is basically yes. They were all killed. They were clearly all killed by an animal, a wild animal. And we know this because in France, this is probably true everywhere in Europe, actually, in the early modern period, from about 1600 forward, parish priests were required to note the passing of anyone in their parish and to note the cause of death. And on many of these death notices, the cause of death is specified, and the priest will say, another one has fallen to the ferocious beast that roams across our territory, or even describe the condition of the body. They weren't all killed in exactly the same way. At least 20 people had their heads severed, which, you know, is a continuing source of speculation to this very day. Hey, wait a minute. If there's a creature severing heads, doesn't that suggest that maybe there's a serial killer at work or some human agent who's really responsible for this? But in fact, we're pretty sure that this is the way that wolves went after their prey. They went for the neck, and so they often severed the head. Not always, but often. And yeah, Morinas, yes, he was... The National Enquirer can trace its lineage, I would say. Back to the Courrier d'Avignon, yeah. He was not above stretching the truth and telling outright tales in order to sell his newspapers. So, yeah. So in that way too, modern journalism was born in the 18th century.